Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and supporters. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Henrik, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. If you're new to the show, this is Red Eyes Radio, independent alternative radio on the alt-right, new right, or just right, whatever you prefer. Today, we offer you a different voice among the many we've spoken to in the last few years that legitimately lament about white displacement, population replacement, and white genocide. I think people like our guest today is a very important ally to have to get people to listen who would otherwise never be willing to listen to our claims and just dismiss them out of sheer ignorance. White liberals who never take their own side, who never listen to their own, would, out of their own prejudice, listen to someone who in their mind never could be accused of having a racist thought in their mind. What would it mean if white people were gone? What would disappear? What would we miss? How would things change? What are some of the traits and properties that would be lost? How has things already changed in many of our ancient capitals where we now either already have become a minority or are rapidly moving in that direction? Our guest is Frank Raymond. Born in the Indian subcontinent, he spent his early life in Calcutta, Darjeeling, and Dhaka in Bangladesh. He went to college and university in England and witnessed at first hand the Marxism that was undermining Britain and the cultural Marxism that dominated the universities. He returned to Bangladesh and spent many years running an industrial business and immersing himself in the mind and culture of the people of the Indian subcontinent. At the age of 39, he moved to Canada and has since lived in Vancouver. As he realized that Canada was not being built, but rather that a built civilization was being destroyed, he began to research the slow slide and ruination of a once proud Canada. He has stood mute witness as the green, rustic, and charming Vancouver of the past was raised to build high-rises and replace green neighborhoods with slums and rabid warrens of housing estates. As a person of East Indian ethnicity with broad exposure to both the colored and Caucasian races, minds, and cultures, he's able to provide an outsider's insight into the white mind and show how it differs from the mind of other races. He stands for the principle that every race is unique and valuable, but he opposes the cultural Marxist and liberal tenet that the white race alone is non-existent, worthless, and dispensable. That's why he has written the book Sweet Dreams and Terror Cells, a work of fiction and literature, but also a sweeping overview of history, anthropology, and the minds of various races. What we'll discuss today is his first book, the opening volume of a great saga titled When Giants Break the Spell. Hi, Frank. Thank you so much for being here. It's very good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Henrik. It's an honor to be on Red Eyes Radio. You folks do wonderful work, and I feel privileged to be on your show.
Well, thank you so much. And you know, you wrote me, I think it's a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, very interesting proposition. And I'd say overall, you're an interesting man. You're unique in many ways. I think not alone. I do know of quite a few now that are from outside the European or Caucasian family, but who are very concerned with what is happening with us. You know, something that I always think is appreciated when we can have people, you know, from the outside, if you will, that can also objectively chime in and raise concerns for actually what is happening or whatnot. But we have a lot to talk about today. And also, of course, your book, the first book in a series, is called When Giants Break the Spell, Sweet Dreams and Terror Cells. That's the part one. Now, before we start and talk more about the book and whatnot, just tell us a little bit about yourself and you know, where you come from and how you ended up writing this book.
Well, I come from the Indian subcontinent. I was born in Calcutta, and I spent my early life in India, but I had an early exposure at the age of five. From the age of 5 to 12, I went to a boarding school that was run by Western people, Australians, Englishmen, Germans. So I had a double culture all the while. I lived in India. I had a very Indian family. By India, I also include Bangladesh, by the way. I had a very Indian background and life, but at the same time, I had this other language, another culture, another set of books. So I was able to live both at the same time. That gives me a bit of a perspective. And at the age of 18, I went to England. I was sent to college and university. My family were able to do that. And I saw the West in person for the first time. And for 7 years, I lived in England, and I absorbed something of the English love for their countryside, how attached they are to their forests and to their green fields. I was also at university, I was exposed to the fact that there was a cultural Marxist element, a very socialist element, full of hatred, I thought. There was a lot of envy and jealousy, a lot of politics. After that, after those 7 years, I went back, this time to Bangladesh. My family has a business in Bangladesh. And I spent some very intense years running a business. I wasn't the kind of man who sat in an office or in our house was in an upper class enclave, but I didn't just confine myself to that. I went into every slum, every village, every aspect of society, and I got to understand my people. At the sort of the level of the raw earth, at the grassroots.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, I'm rather uniquely positioned, or maybe not uniquely, well positioned to see things in the West from the point of view of an outsider.
Exactly. And I think that's super important, to be honest. It's something I want to touch more upon later. But, you know, some people have been calling the book a politically incorrect thriller. It's a book about genocide of white people, and also about the unique qualities of whites and their minds and their way of life, etc., about their spirituality. How would you kind of open this up to someone who's new to the topic, or kind of as an introduction to what you talk about in the book, Frank?
I would open them up by telling them that they think that there is nothing unique about themselves, about whites. In fact, the only thing unique about them is that they're other bad people. They've done terrible things in their history. But they've been told over and over, you're a dispensable people, there's nothing special about you. If you vanish, so what? If you become a minority, so what? They're told that. But I would remind them that, wait a minute, there's things that you take for granted as a way of life, and they're going to go. There other peoples don't have those things. I gave a very small example of crossword puzzles. White people do crossword puzzles, even Russians do them. They take it for granted that they'll open the newspaper and they can do a crossword puzzle if they're sitting on the bus or the train or having a coffee in their own home, right?
Right.
What they don't know is that there is no such thing as a crossword puzzle outside the white world. And the people that have now poured into the white countries, say in Vancouver where I live, this is turning into a Chinese city.
Yeah.
And there are Chinese people who've been here for 3 generations, 4 generations, but they don't do crossword puzzles. Now,
I didn't know that.
Well, I go on public transit all the time. I never see them do it. I used to tutor in people's houses. I never saw them do it in their houses. So that's rather a unique groove of the white mind. And the same person who says that if Canada became a Somali country, if we brought in 40 million Somalis, then soon they were Canadian. They were all the 90% of Canadians. Nothing would change. Something would change. Very deep things would change. Very things that are central to your spirituality and your happiness and your sense of who you are. That would change. Crossword puzzles are a very minor thing, but that's certainly something that would change, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Very minor, but in the course of this talk, I hope to go into the very heart of a person's inner mind, his spirituality, what he resonates to in his soul. And these things are related to race. A white person can thrill to something like The Hobbit, far over the misty mountains, cold through caverns dim and dungeons old. We must away at break of day to seek the long forgotten gold. And he can imagine the dwarves sitting in the house of Bilbo the Hobbit and the firelight flickering on the walls and they talking about these thoughts of distant mountain ranges and valleys and adventures to be had there. That wouldn't resonate with an Indonesian.
Right, yeah.
It goes very deep indeed. Now, I wonder if you'd like me to make a statement about the general situation in the white world, but maybe I don't
Yeah.
have to. You're
No, that would be great actually. Give us your perspective on what is happening here basically.
okay, so I'm giving the perspective of an outsider, just as in a marriage, when a man and a woman have been married for a long time, and someone tells the wife that, by the way, your husband has been seeing this other woman, right? She's in the marriage. She has many memories of them going through difficulties together, of him rescuing her from many situations. So she has trouble being in the situation, understanding it. An outsider has a clearer point of view sometimes. So let me give you the point of view of an outsider. And if this gets a bit long-winded, just stop me, okay?
Sure, no, go ahead.
It is said that the death of a man or woman is not a singular momentary event. It is a process that takes place over a span of time. Your people, the Caucasian people, after a very long and very productive life, are dying. They are dying as they go to school, lesson by lesson, book by book, one young boy at a time, another young girl at a time, as he and she are nudged and conditioned towards homosexuality and lesbianism rather than marriage and family. They are dying movie by movie, man by man, with yet another man that does not marry, another unborn baby, and another family that might have been. Some people choose to leave this life by way of suicide by cop, that is, suicide by police bullets. Your people are undergoing suicide by feminist. Yes, it is one feminist teacher after another, as yet another woman is brainwashed to be sterile, as she leaves no children to feed her in her old age, to grow the crops she needs to eat in her twilight years. And then she asks for a colored replacer and colonist to be brought in to grow the crops and collect the garbage. Your people are dying newspaper by newspaper, politician by politician, as these aliens, collaborators, and traitors pump in another alien, another so-called immigrant, another so-called refugee, to take the place of a native white, replace them, and squeeze them out of their homes and resources. Today, you are seeing some actual murders and rapes of your people in his homelands, as in the New Year's Eve molestation of women by so-called refugees in Cologne. Well, first, white persons have been mind raped, and it follows as a consequence that they will be physically raped. However, the key point is that your people are not dying a natural death. The incremental fading of the white race is not a consequence of technology or prosperity, of the ease of travel and migration by way of aircraft, or of white people being too lazy to collect the garbage, to pick the berries and work in orange orchards. A group of people, who I shall refer to as the sneak rulers, are engineering the process. The white race is not dying a natural death. It is being strangled, murdered. The murder of any ethnic group is genocide, and as a moral person, I, Frank Raymond, stand against it. Every life form, every species, every subspecies is unique and valuable. Another word for subspecies is breed or race. Each of them is a treasure. Each and every tribe of the Amazon is a treasure, irreplaceable. Similarly, the white tribe is a treasure, irreplaceable. I stand against the genocide of any race. Hence, I stand against the genocide of the white race. I stand with the Tibetan people being genocided by the present Chinese regime. And I stand with the Caucasian race presently being genocided by a power that controls the media and hence the minds of Caucasian people.
Yeah.
The Caucasians are being genocided first by the sneak rulers who have mind raped them, subverted their nation states, and opened wide their borders. They are the enemy within the gates, who have opened the gates of the city to the invaders and colonists. They have done it before, many times in history. They have worked at the genocide of the white people, at this genocide of the white peoples for at least 2 centuries. But more recently, there has arisen a new breed of genocider who are piggybacking on the sneak rulers. They parrot their idea viruses. They mouth their word weapons such as racist and xenophobia. These new genociders are the more greedy and cunning individuals among the colonists. They aspire to seize and possess the white lands for their ethnicities, whether it's Chinese or East Indian or African, and they hypocritically preach and thunder about racism and white supremacism. Now you wonder what the aim is. What is the aim of the sneak rulers? The aim of the colonists is a simple one. They just want these green and pleasant lands, relatively empty lands. But what is the aim of the sneak rulers? The aim of the sneak rulers is to turn all the white lands, from North America to Europe to Australia and New Zealand, into a giant superstate. And this is now in embryonic form as the European Union. The superstate is to be populated by a mongrel mass of colored races and ruled by the sneaks. The sneaks are the greatest racists and racial oppressors on the face of the planet. They have an outlook, a vision, and a plan, a satanic plan. The view of the sneaks is this, their goal is this. They shall be the only fair-skinned and beautiful people on earth, a ruling class whose dominion will be naturally accepted by the ugly colored mongrels, who will be made mediocre due to mongrelization. The mongrel proles, and I use the word proles as in the sense of George Orwell's 1984.
Right.
The mongrel proles will live for bread alone with a few televised circuses. That is the vision and outlook of the sneak rulers, and it requires the extermination, blending out, and replacement of the white peoples. But there is many a slip between the cup and the lip. And the sneaks may be killed off by one or more of the races and nations that they are importing into the West. We are seeing a historic phenomenon, the deliberate extinction of one of the four branches of humanity taking place over three continents. We are witnessing a historic first. For the first time, a people is being dispossessed of its land, colonized, replaced, and driven to extinction, not by weapons and armies, but by mind control, by being driven to insanity. The sneak rulers are also mind masters. They have transformed the white person into a lemming, running to the cliff edge to jump and fall and die. Many whites, known as white liberals, have been trained to beg for their own dispossession and the death of their people. And they do so. They beg. Now, whites have been indoctrinated to believe that they have no value, no uniqueness, no identity as a racial group.
Yeah.
They are told that they are members of the human species, but not members of any racial group within it. The white race does not exist, since races do not exist. So runs the politically correct dogma. As such, they say, a white man or woman would lose nothing if his Sweden or his Canada were peopled entirely by Africans. They say he would feel at home among them. I am among my fellow humans, a liberal would say, in an apartment building in a city peopled fully by Somalis. On the other hand, and to the contrary, a white person is told that he does have an identity. He does belong to a group. He does belong to a race. Ah, it's a bad one. He's a slaver who flogged slaves in cotton plantations, an imperialist who built his country's prosperity by robbing Africans and Asians. On the movie screen and TV screen, on the advertisements, the white is the worthless man or woman. Most often, he's a worthless man, a worthless male. He's weak, indecisive, shifty, criminal, a follower, not a leader, treacherous and spineless. On the very few occasions on which a white male is strong, he's evil. The only strong white male man is an evil white man.
True.
But now we come to what I have been writing about. But do whites have no unique, different qualities as a race, as a breed, as a subspecies? Could they be happy living among aliens in an alien majority or alien accommodating society? Would they lose nothing? Would the world lose nothing? Consider, white men and women like crossword puzzles. People of other races do not do crosswords, even after generations of living in white societies and white cultures. They don't hold dog shows. They don't do bird watching. If, or rather, when Vancouver becomes a Chinese city, the few whites left will not have crossword puzzles to amuse themselves with, will not be able to organize dog shows, and will certainly not be able to do any bird watching. Now, how many parts whites know about these aspects of their identity, these unique aspects of their unique identity? And they will have to read Chinese language newspapers, not English ones. That's just the way it goes when you've been colonized. However, The identity, the happiness, and the spiritual fulfillment of a people goes deeper than crossword puzzles and talk shows. It goes deeper even than language. For example, you will notice that in the hospitals, they collect teddy bears. And they collect teddy bears and give them to the elderly, aging patients. And I've often seen in a hospital an old man on a gurney or in a wheelchair holding on to a teddy bear here in Canada. But a colored person would see that as a sign of childishness, as a streak of insanity. So what will happen when colored people are setting the tone of society, as they're doing more and more, they will laugh at these men, and those old white men will refrain from hanging on to that teddy bear. He will not dare to treasure and hold on to that teddy bear because he'll be daunted by the laughter and the mocking. However, the teddy bear is only one outward symptom of something very deep and fundamental indeed. The happiness and spiritual fulfillment of a people reach into the innermost yearnings and the psychic core of a people, into its very soul. And that is what my book explores to a large extent. Identity, spirituality, soul. Whites will lose that which they hold most precious as they lose more of their lands and cease to have neighborhoods, streets, schools, community halls, and community meetings of their own people, of their own kind. They will lose, they are already losing, the green spaces, the green strips in the cities, the majestic forests that they so cherish. For the white mind is a forest mind, a mind that dwells in the forest fringed by the changing sea. They will lose all that because they have lost the right of any ethnic group, any racial group, the right of self-determination. They will lose their very souls. And the world will lose much of what enriches it. It will lose the only race that is struggling to save animals, plants, the ecological system, and nature itself, as the human species continues to foul its tiny nest. Life on the planet, the very continuation of life on the planet, now depends on the survival of the white race and on its resistance to the genociders.
Wow.
That's my opening statement.
Well, thank you so much for that. I mean, how important that is to hear and to get recognized as well. You know, I wanted to ask you, I guess, just how you ended up on this side. I mean, you said earlier that you never really kind of fell for the left-wing dogma that is existence in the West. But I guess some would say that, you know, you suffer from Stockholm syndrome or something, right? Considering what we hear about what the British did in India, for example, right? I mean, why did you feel a need to write this and to give this out from your perspective?
Well, you mentioned something interesting, what the British did in India, right?
Right.
There is not a single Indian that feels that what the British did in India entitles him to live in England and to colonize England. But they say it when they need to say it. They're very good at, you know, I know such Indians. I talk to them, I've met them, I've seen them indulge in these things. When some Englishman says that this is our country and you're crowding it up, you're ruining the flavor, the English flavor of it. They say, well, you came to India and lived in our country, now we'll come to yours. You know,
yep.
It's only right. You ruled us, you exploited us, now we're going to come to yours. But every one of those Indians, when he's talking to me privately, then it's a different matter. He said, I just said that to put him on the defensive.
Right.
I know perfectly well that if it was wrong for the English to come to India and to rule it, it's equally wrong for us to colonize England.
Of course.
The reason I'm going to England is not to get some kind of revenge or to equalize things. The fact is that India is a land swampy country. The soil is arid and depleted. It's not a green country. It's full of mosquitoes. It's also humid. It's bloody unpleasant. Compared to that, the green and pleasant land of England, with its rolling hills, its fertile soil, its larger spaces, is so much more beautiful. And the civilization there is so much more advanced. It's so much more comfortable. That's why I want to go.
Isn't it too cold, though?
Oh, it's not too cold if you have heating. And after a couple of months there, that Indian doesn't want to go back. Then he lays claim to the land.
Right.
He says, you know, he has different mechanisms. I don't want to get into it, but it's a big subject. The point is, an Indian would not give up one inch of his country. If there was a terrible pestilence in China and famine, he would not let even 10 million Chinese into India. He'd say,
right.
You must be crazy. You know, we are a particular group. This is our in-group. We own this land is what we depend on for our livelihood. And we don't want these aliens here. These aliens are totally alien. They don't have our mind, our soul. Now, that actually answers your question, that because we would regard this as madness, we would not allow ourselves to be colonized unless it was by overwhelming force, we can easily see that a form of madness has seized the white countries. Either they've gone mad or someone has driven them mad.
Right, yeah. Now, yeah, I don't know if you said everything you wanted to say so far about this, but why do you, as an Indian person, feel the need to write this down?
Well, I feel the need for a number of reasons. I would stand for any people that is being genocided. I would stand for any people. But I would stand for the white people more because we know the non-white peoples, the colored peoples, we know that the white people are the best stewards of the earth, of human decency and of a global social system. It is whites who go voluntarily to Africa to build tube wells in schools. It is whites who seek to help the so-called refugees from the Middle East, while the Saudis and Kuwaitis say, bugger off, we don't give a damn. If the world is to have any kind of a social order, it is whites who will lead that. It is they who feel responsible. And certainly when it comes to the ecology, the environment, it is whites, only whites who will do anything about it. Well, let me put it also this way. We see the racial situation much more keenly. Despite all the propaganda, we see it very, very well. We know who's going to turn society into a kind of hellhole like Liberia. Well, I think they give it a different name now, or Haiti. And who will keep society orderly, decent, and prosperous. Now, there was an incident in New York in September 2013. A Chinese man, his name was Alexian Lien, L-I-E-N. This man was a well-off banker. You know, he worked in the New York banking system, had a good income, good money. And he was with his wife and child going somewhere on a trip, driving along. And suddenly he found himself surrounded by bikers. And one of the bikers braked, slowed down in front of him, and he couldn't help. He collided into this biker. This biker actually slowed down right in front of him, and he hit him. He collided with him. Well, because these bikers appeared so rowdy and violent, he ran. Well, they pursued him. They smashed his windows and beat him up and nearly killed him. Now, as it happened, these bikers it was a black biker gang. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a black biker gang, but
right.
It was.
Yep.
It was a black biker gang with one or two Hispanics. Now, at that time, I was working on a project with some Chinese people, and I asked them, and I was amazed at how closely they followed that incident, because it was one of their fellow Chinese who had been involved. He had been surrounded by lawless people who smashed open his windows, beat him up in the middle of the street, would have killed him. Their point of view, speaking frankly to me and among themselves, was, you know what, when whites diminish, as whites are diminishing, the safety that we took for granted, the social order, is going.
Yeah.
This is our future if the whites diminish any further. We come to these white countries, Sweden, Germany, Austria, Australia, because we feel that the whites have a certain genius for keeping an orderly society, that they have a natural sense of let's wait in line instead of trying to barge ahead in line. Let's do this according to a certain sense of collective responsibility. So they all feel safe walking in a suburb in a white country. None of them would safe walking in a suburb in, say, Mogadishu or
right.
Lagos in Nigeria. But then they look at the situation where more and more colored people are becoming a larger proportion, and they think it's going to turn into bloody Liberia or Uganda.
You know what? Let me just cut you off there quickly, because it's interesting you mentioned Liberia. Just learned about it today. It was actually Brandon Martinez, a previous guest, has sent it to me about Liberian nationality law. I had no idea. It's actually one of the few, you know, countries that actually is openly, explicitly racist in its nationality law. The following is from Wikipedia about this. It says, Liberia is one of the relatively few remaining countries in the world conferring nationality solely on the basis of race. Under the Liberian constitution, only persons of black African origins may obtain citizenship, although Liberian law allows members of other races to hold permanent residency status. Within Liberia itself, the wider implication of the policy are part of a heated debate in which native Liberians themselves have acknowledged that non-African permanent residents are crucial contributors to the country's economic activities and innovation system, mainly by the wealthy of the Lebanese community there. But anyway, I found that interesting. I didn't know that, actually.
Well, why would it surprise you? The Japanese run a racial state. The Chinese run a racial state. It may not be in their law, but in practice, that's how they run it.
True. Mexico, too, by the way. They had a law that, you know, if immigration upsets their nationality, in terms of homogeneity, you know, they have actually said that we're not going to allow those people to come in. So they have a very explicit also racial policy in that regard.
No, that's, you know, everybody is racial. What is a country? A country is exclusive. Now in Europe, they say, oh, we won't have that kind of exclusionism or exclusivity. But that's what a country is. That's what a state should be, exclusive. Japan exists because it's exclusively for the Japanese.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be Japan. But I wanted to, you asked me a question, and I'd really like to answer that question. What triggered me into writing this, okay?
Right.
I'll give you two specific triggers. When I was a young man, not a young man, a boy, we had a poetry book in which there was a song called, it started with Silver is the River. It talked about boys in England who were by a river and they floated paper boats down the river. And they were very curious about where the winds and waves of the river would take it, where the boats would land. The random forces would, so many random forces in the universe, where would they land, and so where somebody else might pick up their boat and see the message in it, right? So I can't really recite very well, so I'll try to sing it for you, a few lines, right?
Nice.
Okay. Silver is the river, golden is the sand. It goes on forever with trees on either hand. Green leaves are floating, castles on the foam. Boats of mine are drifting, where we'll all come home. Away down the river, 100 miles or more, other little children will bring my boats ashore. So,
thank you, brother. I think that's the first song on the show. Actually, in 10 years, I don't think anybody has sung before, so that's actually really cool. Thanks.
I'm really bad at reciting. I'm not very good at reading poetry or a song. I'm better singing.
Nice. Yep.
So they have this fascination, away down the river, 100 miles or more, other little children will bring my boats ashore. Now, when I was living in England, I used to see children doing that. And it struck me that English children do it, but in India, nobody would think of doing it. They wouldn't have this curiosity, where will they go? Who will pick up my message, right? I'll write a little message in the boat. Who will bring my boat ashore? Somebody else might read my message. They wouldn't do it. An Indian child wouldn't do it. Now, one day on the beach here in Canada, on the West Coast, I saw people putting messages into bottles and setting them. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And they said, well, when we take the boat out, we're going to throw the bottle out at sea, and we hope this message will reach somebody in Australia or New Zealand or Japan and see what happens, right? The message in a bottle is fairly well known. It's a very common habit with white people.
Yeah, I remember doing that when I was a young boy, actually. I remember how exciting it was to think about that, to think about where, just as you said, where will it end up? What's the possibility here? What shores will it reach, you know?
Mm-hmm. So I see these people standing on the shores of the immense ocean, impressed by the immensity of it, of the winds and the waves, the randomness of all the forces in the universe, and the unknown. Where on earth will it go? Because it's a huge earth out there, and a huge universe beyond that. Faced with the mysteries of nature, the immensity of nature, the confusion of all these contending forces, and yet they want to connect with another human being. They are hoping that somebody in New Zealand might pick it up and read what they have to say. And in that way, they connect with someone on a distant shore. Now, that's the kind of romance that is unique to whites, right? There's nobody else, as far as I know, does it. And I think from my knowledge of other races, they'd find it a bit silly. They'd say, wow, so what? Who cares?
You can use the bottle for something else, maybe.
Now, something happened only a week ago here in the Vancouver area. Someone was walking on the beach and they found a beer bottle which has been well sealed. And they said, wait, there's something special about it. There's some ashes in it. So they opened this beer bottle, which had drifted ashore. And there was a message in it from someone who called himself Biker Bob. He said, I've always been a roamer and a traveler. That's the message in the bottle. I'm Biker Bob. I've always been a roamer and a traveler. Read my message, add to it if you like, but then set me free to continue on my journey. And this man did that. He took his boat out and set him free. But then the bottle came ashore in another, not too far away. And this couple found the bottle. And they said, yeah, we really have to set Biker Bob on his journey. But before that, they took the bottle to the local pub and they sat it on a chair and they all had a drink in honor of Biker Bob and they all wished him well. Basically addressing the bottle and said, we'll even pour a little beer into the bottle so Biker Bob can still have a drink. And then this man said, it came out in the papers. He said that I'm going to take my boat out far into the ocean so that he will float with the tides somewhere else and not just come back to shore. Now, think about it. Nobody else has this kind of romance. Not the Chinese, not the Japanese, not the Africans, not the Amerindians. They don't have that sense of romance, that sense of reverence for the unknown, that kind of spirit of play in which they'll say, yes, let's continue his journey through the world. And let's have a drink in his favor. Let's put him on a chair as if Biker Bob is still among us. Now, there's a lot there, actually. A lot that speaks to the romance, the sense of mystery, the sense of social connection, of connecting with strangers that is very unique to white people. But the thing is that there are enough white people that it comes out in the papers and they all seem to, and everyone gets some sense of satisfaction out of it. When Sweden becomes 90% Somali, say, I'm just saying theoretically, or Arab, it won't come out in the papers.
Right.
That is a part of your way of life that will just vanish.
Yeah.
You will not be able to share this thing, this feeling, and share it with the rest of your community throughout Sweden. You won't be able to do it. Because the media, the papers will serve other people to whom this is just something silly and stupid.
Right.
It has no romantic value to you. So, Biker Bob, you might say, is part of the white soul. And if someone then says that there is nothing unique or different about the white race, you have to think about Biker Bob for a minute.
I will. Yeah.
There was something that struck me very hard one day, and I actually put this in my book. Perhaps you watched the movie Hocus Pocus. It came out in the year 93, and it's about three witches that come to a New England town on the eve of Halloween. And it's a modern New England town, you know, with buses and cars and everything, but these three witches from another time. And the movie is for children mainly. Now, one of the heroes of my book, Shane Douglas, he recounts this. He had bought, and so I'll read from my book for a minute
Go ahead.
He had bought a DVD of the 1993 movie, Hocus Pocus, and he and his daughter, Cheryl, had watched it together. Three witches had come to a New England town on the eve of Halloween, or rather Samhain, that night in which the veils between the worlds are at their thinnest, when spirits and lost souls and magical beings, elves and fairies, goblins and hobgoblins can cross over for a time. It is the time when children go from door to door saying trick or treats, and your wife welcomes them at the door in a high witch hat. For years, Shane had seen the mythical and spiritual life, the folk traditions of his people being eroded and demeaned by the social regime that was slowly, and now not so slowly, genociding his people. Between Hollywood, MTV, and the debasement of the educational system, white children and youth were being debased, torn from their richly textured heritage, and turned into cheap cosmopolitan trash, deliberately and by design. Gangster rap, hip-hop, and the wearing of baseball caps backwards were only the most glaring elements of the design and the mass trend. And this movie, Hocus Pocus, was an example of that decline. It was not as vivid or as folkish as it might have been, certainly not on the level of The Wizard of Oz, which had been produced in 1939.
Right.
Yet at least it had witches, Halloween, and enchantment. Cheryl, his daughter, had liked one scene in particular. The youngest witch, a pretty thing, soared into the air on her broomstick, swaying gracefully into the air to tempt the children with a siren song. As she sang, the camera panned and zoomed, and the vast stretch and curve of coastline came into view, the dark sea flanking and the land dotted with lights like fireflies, reminiscent of the magic lights of a Christmas tree. The witch floated and swept forward through the air, her purple cape fluttering, and the haunting strains of her melody were seductive. Come, little children, the time's come to play here in my garden of magic. And the children sleepwalked forth into the moonlight, tempted and drawn by the seduction that reached into their folk souls. Some months ago, Shane had looked for this scene on YouTube. Some of the videos that showed the scene of the witch floating in the air and calling to the children had wonderful artistic paintings of similar scenes, evocative and eerie, touching the folk mind and echoing in the inner caverns of the white folk heart. In one, a witch sat astride a broomstick, a large jack-o'-lantern on her lap with the candles burning inside, while the moon loomed large over her shoulder in the background, and bats flitted across its luminous face in mysterious and faintly disturbing manner. Shane read the comments below the videos. Almost all the comments below the videos were positive. One comment ran, "I love this song. It is creepy, eerie, haunting, and yet pleasant and calming, entrancing, and somehow hypnotic and seductive." Another person expressed his mind in the words, "This song is like walking through a forest into a town at night, singing this melody, my blood-red cape swaying in the wind, looking like a ghost." But one comment struck a discord. This comment ran, "Man, this wacko cracker shit tells it like it is with how messed up and fucked up these crackers are. No wonder you're on the way out, you MFs." Now, I saw that myself on YouTube. I saw this comment myself. "Man, this wacko cracker shit tells it like how messed up and fucked up these crackers are. No wonder you're on the way out, you motherfuckers." Now, when I saw that comment, I realized that if whites want to preserve their folk spirit and the things that are precious to them, like this kind of vision, they can't do it in a society full of other people's. So I expressed that in my book. From the language, it was plainly a black person, and he was entitled to his opinion. Well, you couldn't expect a black person to appreciate a work of imagination that dwelt in the channels, groves, and inner byways of the white mind, formed over millennia and generations in the forests of the northern clime, rich in nuance and detail garnered over misty spring mornings, gusty autumn seasons, and the magic of snow on cedars and firs. He did not expect a non-white to thrill to culture nuggets of the white soul, gathered while rowing with mole and rat of wind in the willows, through narrow streamlets whose banks were fringed by woodbine, honeysuckle, rushes, and pussy willows. This black man and his people have their own souls and culture. Shane respected that and wished them well. But we cannot have and retain our culture, our mythic minds, what we cherish and value, when we dwell among other peoples. We cannot have our mythic life, what we hold precious, when we do not have a living space of our own, a media of our own, and schools of our own. When we do not have community halls of our own to gather in a comforting and enriching fellowship of kinsfolk, of like-minded hearts and souls, from the same route and the same journey through time. We are shuffling through a life in subverted nations, and in the nightmare society we are heading towards, the schools, the books, and movies will cater to the likes and tastes of black men and oriental women, for they will be the majority. They are the majority on the planet, and are already the majority in most of our cities.
Yeah.
For them, our mythic life is cracker shit. And the enemy will shape or misshape the culture as it does today. Without living space there is of our own, there is only one fate for us, the fate designed by the enemy, to be plastic men and women with the plastic tables of McDonald's, living for bread alone, blobs of yeast, lower than the noble lion and the appealing raccoon that at least have genuine feelings and uncorrupted natures. Now, Henrik, I wonder if that tells you some of the things that triggered me to write a book that expresses what it is that the world would lose and what white people would lose unless they have a country of their own.
Right. Yeah.
Because these other peoples will laugh at you. These things that are precious to you are just stupidity to them. My main purpose is to show that the white or Caucasian branch of humanity has a unique mind, romance, spirituality, and unique contributions to the sum of human happiness. That is my purpose. I wonder if you had some observations on that.
Well, I do. And I mean, at first, you know, these are, you know, they're small things to a certain extent. There might even seem arbitrary, maybe even to whites to a certain extent. But it's like, it's as anything, right? If it's like to ask the goldfish who's in a fishbowl to describe the water that they are in, they don't even know what it is. They're surrounded by it all the time. They're in it all the time. Yes, as we're getting displaced and whatnot, you come up against those differences and they become more noticeable in that way. In other words, you get an indication, a stronger indication, maybe what these cultural differences are when the forced multiculturalism happens. But I think the main point is that, as I said, despite that these might seem as small and arbitrary, they are part of a much bigger and very severe and horrific plan that's in the works, right? Dispossession of an entire people. And as you say, I'm with you on that page. I mean, I oppose genocide of any people. You know, it's like you would do that across the board in terms of whoever was, targeted in this way. So I think it's a really important, you know, thing that you've done in terms of trying to highlight these things, to put some focus on differences, and also try to understand what it is that would be lost. And obviously, there is an endless slew of more things that we could add on to it. But I like it because it's the small detail things that tells us a bit more about our maybe emotional state, our mind, and parts of our soul. So I like it.
Well, I can tell you the reaction of a liberal to some of these things. Even when you tell them that this is what you would lose, they don't quite believe you when you say that. So I'm going to tell you a true story. And first I'll tell you of a work of fiction, The White Mind, and I'll try to keep it short. I'll keep it short. And then I'll tell you the reaction. Nowadays, whites don't produce, under this regime, which controls even the publication, you know, the book publishing industry to a large extent, the creative writing of the white soul is not produced. But at one time it was, in the 60s, early 70s, there was still a lot of good creative work coming out. One of them was a story called The Story of Thomas P. Kahn, K-A-N-N-E. Thomas P. Kahn, this is a short story. Thomas P. Kahn was a young boy of about 17, and he was in one of these cities in the U.S., a mid-sized city, and he was a bad boy. He was kind of isolated, loner. But what he did was, he went around writing everywhere, phantom snake rules. You know, with a spray can or a paintbrush, he'd write phantom snake rules. And he'd deface things. But phantom snake was an anagram for Thomas P. Kahn. Thomas P. K-A-N-N-E, if the letters are rearranged, it becomes phantom snake. It's an anagram. Now, as it happens, there's no such thing as an anagram outside the white world. You didn't know that.
No, I did not.
No, anagrams don't exist in any other race. They just don't do them. So
interesting.
Now, he didn't like the man in this museum. There was a museum of which had all kinds of ancient cultures in it, sarcophaguses and Egyptian pharaohs and Roman stuff. And there was a boring man there. His name was Bausin, B-A-U-S-I-N. And he looked like a boring clerk. And he worked in this museum and he cleaned it up and he arranged the exhibits. And he was a boring man. And this young boy, Thomas P. Kahn, would spray paint in the museum, phantom snake rules. And poor Bausin had to clean it. Well, one day, after having made trouble around the town, this young chap, who, you know, who was a loner and not a very bold person, but he got a kick out of these things, these sneak attacks. He got into the museum and he was spray painting away here and there, phantom snake rules, phantom snake rules. And he didn't realize it, but it was already evening. It was getting dark. And before he knew it, he seemed to fall asleep. When he woke up, it was the museum has closed, and he was locked in. You know, he had known about. He ended up having to hide, and he had to hide. Mm-hmm. They were searching for him. They were saying somebody here is free, and he had to hide. And while he was hiding, the museum was closed, locked up for the night. In the semi-darkness, when he woke up from a nap, in the semi-darkness, he tried to find a way out of the deserted building while eluding the boring Mr. Bausin. And there, he was cornered in the Egyptian exhibition. The Egyptian exhibition had sarcophagus and statues of the pharaohs, statues of their gods. And there in the darkness, in this immense building, in the Egyptian exhibition, suddenly a giant feral jackal seemed to seize upon him. From behind, he saw the fur. He was caught by this huge paw, and then he was drugged and paralyzed. The next thing he knew, he woke up in a sarcophagus, swathed in the wrappings of a mummy, completely tied up and bound in the wrappings of a mummy. And there was a voice chanting, "Oh, great Pharaoh, accept as a slave and a servant in the underworld, this one who has desecrated thy shrine, oh, master." And he looked around, and there was a jackal-headed man talking. "Oh, my master, it was I, Anubis, who ever watched over thee." The jackal-headed man continued, "I fill his veins with the mystic fluids." And an injection went into this boy, and cold fluids came into him and completely paralyzed and froze him up. And soon the jackal-headed one sealed him inside the sarcophagus, never to be seen again. The story came to its conclusion. It was some days later. It was at the dead of night when the final graffiti message was written. It was carved underneath the base of the statue of Anubis. So it would have been noticed only by the museum staff, but not so much by the public. Mr. Bausin had taken loving care in inscribing the message. "Phantom snake rules no more. Bausin is Anubis." So Bausin, B-A-U-S-I-N, could be rearranged as Anubis.
Right.
Now, by the standards of the English-speaking peoples, it's not a brilliant story. But think about it. No colored author has ever conceived anything remotely like it in terms of imagination and development of plot. Now, if you told the normal white person that, they'd refuse to believe it, politically incorrect.
Right.
But no author in India or Indonesia has woven into a story the religion and gods of another country, of an ancient civilization, transported the icons of that ancient civilization into the modern world, into a city in their country in the modern world. Nobody would make an insightful problem character study of this kind of insecure, troublemaking boy with a fevered imagination who hid behind an anagram and chuckled that he was devilishly clever. No one would figure out that Phantom Snake was Thomas P. Cann. And certainly no colored author would twist the plot to arrive at the surprising ending that the nondescript museum curator could change shape was actually the jackal god of the ancient Egyptians. It's not a conception that an Indian man or an Arab man would even think about, that walking among us is a man who's actually the jackal god of the ancient Egyptian pantheon of gods. And he's the boring Mr. Bowsen. And certainly no one would end with that twist, Bowsen is Anubis. The anagram maker was hoisted by his own petard.
Right,
now,
right.
People are losing this kind of imagination, this kind of culture, but they don't realize that it's totally unique to the white peoples. Okay?
Yeah.
So I told the story to a liberal, and I told one more story, and I think I'll just tell this one, and then we'll stop the stories. But I'll tell this one very briefly. This was a story I read in a book that I can't remember the name of the story or the name of the author, because it is one grain, one leaf in a vast tree. The white mind has produced so much that you can't even locate sometimes some of the rich nuggets that is produced. There was a man who went to a mountain village to have a break. It was a village in the mountains, well forested, and he'd take a break and walk in the forest, and he'd hunt from time to time. That's not something that colored people do, actually, in their lives. But it happens in America, especially in the Rockies. And there was this dog, one of these pointer dogs that people take for hunting to find birds, basically. You know, the dog points at a bush, and it's a bush full of grouse or whatever, pheasants or whatever bird you're hunting. They have a way of doing it. This dog used to look at him thoughtfully and then go away. And then it would look at him, and there was an old man told him, that dog is the devil. Have nothing to do with that dog. Another man in the village grumbled, that dog is bad news. But one day, as this man was just passing time in this mountain village, in this forested place in the Rockies, the dog actually seemed to look right at him and indicate, come with me. And this dog, he followed the dog into the forest and down a trail, down another trail, up a slope, and suddenly he found himself in something quite different. It was as if it was a dramatic landscape of hills rising up, and he knew that these forests are primeval. They've never been cut. They've never been planted. This is the way it was 10,000, 20,000 years ago. These are natural primeval forests, and hidden valleys going through them. And there was something dreamlike about it. And then the dog led him to a place where he could shoot as many grouse and pheasants as he liked. It seemed that it was stocked with it. The place was rich with these birds that he loved to hunt. He shot 6, 12, 20, and then he said no more. And as he was going back, he suddenly realized he didn't know the way back. But the dog knew the way back. It led him through trails and over hidden valleys. And then he stopped because there was something in the sky. There was a huge flight of birds, millions of birds, it seems, covering most of the sky, something that no man had seen in 200 years. It was the flight of a flock of passenger pigeons. Passenger pigeons had gone extinct 2 centuries ago. And he was seeing something that no one would normally see. Then he realized that I must be 200 years back at least, maybe 10,000 years back. And then he got back and he had these beautiful birds all with their magical colors and ruffles and stripes. But the strange thing was that that dog would never take him again. He never could find that valley. He never could find that magic land, that happy hunting ground, that primeval land. And the dog never took him back. He kept asking it, but it just wouldn't. And that's when the old man of the village said, "Told you that dog was a devil. It takes you once. And then after that, you pine away and you long and you have memories. And you slowly just grow sadder and sadder, but you never get to go back." Now, that is the kind of vision or imagination that only white people would have. If you told that to a man in the Middle East, it wouldn't resonate with him. Nothing of that story would resonate with him. So I was walking one day. I had an encounter with a liberal woman, and I said, you know, maybe we should talk about this. And I told her of these two stories, of Thomas P. Kahn and the hunting dog in the mountain village. And basically she said, "Well, what are you going to do about it? This city, we can see very well, this city of Vancouver is going to be 90% Chinese and 5 to 7% other people, East Indians and whatnot, and be maybe 3% whites."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, what do you think about that?" I said, "Kathleen, what do you think about that? What kind of a society will it be?" She thought for a moment, and this is a 70-year-old woman who had been a teacher all her life and had now retired and was still strong and vigorous, still vigorous of mind. She thinks for a moment and says, "It'll be a better society."
Yeah.
I said, "Better? How will it be better?" "Well, I said, no, you have to tell me, how will it be better? If it's 95% Chinese, this city that was built by European people and peopled by European people for almost two centuries, if it becomes Chinese, you say it'll be better. How will it be better? Tell me that." I said, "Are you trying to imply that the Chinese are a better people?" So she thought about it for a bit, and finally she said, "Life goes round in circles. It's like seasons. As the seasons go round, life goes round in circles." I said, "Well, if it goes round in circles, it'll come back to the same place. It won't get anywhere better." She said, "No, it's like a spiral. A spiral goes round and round, but it moves forward. A spiral goes round and round, but it moves forward. It progresses. It goes to a better place." So I said, "And what does that mean?" "Well," she said, "our time is over. In the cycle of seasons, in the seasons of life, in the seasons of peoples and races, our time, the time of the white peoples, is over. And we are being replaced by a more progressive, a better people." That was basically what she said. "Our time is over and we are being replaced by better people." I said, "Well, tell me how they're better." Here you have a story of Thomas P. Gran and the anagram, Bows in his Anubis. No Chinese person is going to create that kind of story. No Chinese person is going to create the story of the mountain village, the paradise valley, the landscape, traveling back into the primeval forest, the dog that takes you once and never takes you again. You're going to lose all that.
Yeah.
The people who replace you will not have that mythic imagination. They may have other things, but this they won't have. How will it be better? But she was convinced that no, it'll be better, because you know what? The great universe that will bring these people to the forefront in the new cycle, replacing us, that great universe will give them better qualities.
Oh, God. Well, how did they not see that it's not some natural thing. It's utterly artificial. It's not, it's induced. And as you say, obviously you talk about this in terms of what you dub the sneak rulers, you know, that this is what they're bringing in, and it's not some universal, you know, divinely inspired natural progress that's occurring here.
Well, I have studied the issue, and I've decided that the television screen and the movie screen have a deeper impact upon the subconscious than the real life experiences. They have a deeper impact, especially if they can produce faces twisted with emotion and can evoke strong emotions in you.
Yeah.
There are reasons why these things have a much more substantive impact on the psyche. One reason is, for example, someone's watching a movie, they think they're being entertained. Their guard is down. All the barriers and filters are down. They're relaxed. And when they're relaxed, these messages can sneak into their subconscious very easily.
Yeah.
And sink down there in the mud and in the marsh and mud of their subconscious. But, you know, that's a big topic that I'm going to go into in my second book. I thought I'd reveal to you a little more of the white mind and say things that are not so serious, but they tell you that the white mind thinks in a different mental groove. I'm not saying it's a superior mental groove. I didn't say that.
Right, right. Let's do that, and then we can take a break after that. I want to talk a bit more about the book, of course, but let's finish up on that.
Okay, the different mental groove of the white. Now, there was a joke about a man who said, you know, they were mocking this man, who apparently was a reactionary, and they said this guy was very angry about the socialists or the workers or whatever people he didn't like, and said, they burned down my library, both books.
Yeah.
Now, that's a joke you take for granted. But I can assure you from my experience, colored people wouldn't make up that joke. And half of them wouldn't get the joke. Okay? There was a television program called Al Bundy, Married with Children in America. Very funny. Al Bundy, one day, this woman comes up and says, this man, he's a peeping Tom. He climbed up, you know, to my bedroom window, and there he was peeping at me. You know, I was just getting undressed, and he was peeping at me. It was horrible! And Al Bundy says, oh yeah? And how was it for you?
Yep.
No, he turned it around, saying it was horrible for me. But believe me, no Indian, no African would make that up. Their minds think in a different way. There's a man who told me a joke the other day. I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy.
Right.
He'd rather have a bottle of beer in front of him than a frontal lobotomy. Again, that's uniquely white. You wouldn't get a similar joke anywhere in India or the Middle East. I know that. Okay. Now, there are the reversal of words sometimes. I'll give you an example. Now, Americans and Canadians use this word snatch. A woman's pubic area, they call it a snatch.
Right.
She has a nice snatch. Her pubic area is attractive to him. Now, this joke says, what's the difference between a sneak thief and a peeping Tom? And they tell you the joke. The sneak thief snatches watches, but the peeping Tom, and you know that you don't have to tell people the joke, they get it. The sneak thief snatches watches, but the peeping Tom watches snatches.
Right.
So they reverse the W and the S. One of them snatches watches. The peeping Tom watches snatches. You will never get that kind of a joke outside the white world. There are hundreds, thousands of jokes like that with a little reversal. But you won't get that in the white world, okay? Now, I'll give you one last one. What do you get when you throw a piano player, a piano player? What do you get when you throw a pianist down a mine shaft?
Don't know. Tell me.
A flat minor.
Right. Yeah.
Now, that joke would not come out except out of a white mind.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have anything similar to these jokes outside the white world. Nothing comparable. I've asked, you know, I know about my country, I know about Indians, but I've also asked various ethnic people, and they said, we just don't have stuff like that.
Hmm.
Okay? Now, the white mind also runs in a different groove. It picks up things in a way that other people don't. For example, they're very quick at it. I'll give you an example. I had read this history book in which some caliph of Baghdad had said something like, the vapors of vanity and presumption have mounted to your head, young man. So I was in school, and I was talking about some other boy, and I quoted the line. I said, the vapors of vanity and presumption have mounted to his head. And the English boy next to me added, and steamed up his glasses.
Yeah.
Now, the non-white mind can't quickly connect like that and make a, you know, add to it by saying, yes, yes, the vapors have also steamed up his glasses. It just wouldn't do that. I have a lot of experience with people. I was once working as a temporary worker in a bank, just for the evening. But I went there every week, once a week, to work in this bank. And there was a woman who used to tell jokes, and the one day she wasn't telling jokes. So I said to her, oh no, this is a disappointing evening. I haven't heard a single joke today. She looked at me and said, you know what I'd do if I were you? I'd ask for my money back. Yes, she nodded. I'd ask for my money back. Now, that sounds, you would take it for granted that the people around you would have that kind of humor.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were working around Ugandans and Amerindians from, say, Venezuela, you wouldn't get that kind of wit. Once I was discussing a news item with a complete stranger, a woman of about 30, in the mall. And I was saying, well, I wouldn't believe that. Believe nothing. Trust nobody, I said. And she quickly added, and don't be paranoid. So I said, believe nothing. Trust nobody. And she adds on, and don't be paranoid. Again, a non-white mind could not have come up with that. Right?
What do you think that is? Is it just a linguistic ability, or is there another property that comes out through that ability?
It's a mental groove, and people evolve along different paths. Different mental channels evolve. I have found that Chinese students are very good at the manipulations of calculus. They have an advantage. In looking at electrical circuits, the Chinese are way faster. They've just evolved differently.
Yeah.
There was a woman who once posted up, you know, a man actually who worked in the Middle East told me this story. He worked in a college and they were teaching English, and there was an American woman who was also teaching English. And in the staff room, she put up a picture. She'd had a photo of herself next to Bigfoot. Bigfoot is this a hairy gorilla-like monster who supposedly prowls the Rockies. So there was a statue of a figure of Bigfoot, and she posted a picture of herself next to Bigfoot, right? And she wrote on the caption, I'm the one on the right.
That's good. Yes, we don't. Yeah.
Now, the Arabs, and this was in the UAE, they just couldn't understand. What the hell is she writing that? I can see she's on the right.
Yeah.
They just didn't get the point. Okay? For example, there was in Thailand, once an American wife had some guests over, and these were very educated Thai women, upper class, and she'd made a very nice cake. I believe it was, I can't remember exactly what it was. There was caramel on top. It was very nice. Everyone liked it. And they said, oh, we must have the recipe. And she kind of smiled and said, well, I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you. Now, you would take, you know, you'd understand that immediately, right?
Yeah.
These Thai women just didn't get it. You know, some of them had studied in the States, but they just didn't get it. Why would you have to kill us? What are you trying to say?
Right. Yeah.
So, we have a city here called Surrey, big city, and it's a very heavily East Indian area. Anyway, there was a white family there who posted a little notice on their wall, missing husband and dog, reward for dog. You got that immediately.
Yep.
You giggled.
Yep.
But the East Indians walking by were saying, what the hell is that supposed to mean?
Yeah. Well, it shows the difficulty of everyday life, of these cultural clashes, right? When you have, I mean, humor is really an expression of, I don't know, I'm not that good, I guess, at analyzing it, but as it comes to me, as we're talking about this, it's just, I figured it's an expression of something that comes much later in the cultural development, when there is a certain nuance that has been developed by a homogenous people, more or less. I mean, sure, there are of course jokes and humor that crosses, you know, some of those boundaries or whatnot, but you know, those subtleties, those things is a later kind of maturation, I guess I could say, of something that's much later, and that's being lost, and those things are being, as you said, we would have to start to exclude those, not even going into things that of course would be offensive and all that stuff to others, but just on the basis that they wouldn't get them and they would be useless,
they wouldn't get,
you know,
them. Yeah. As I said, that I believe, since I've seen Chinese people who've been born here and highly educated, only the top 5% who are highly educated would even get the jokes.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of them are just mystified. So there is a definite different groove that is along ethnic lines, along racial genetic lines. There is a different groove there. You can't teach this to a certain kind of person. You can't.
Right, right.
I was once having dinner with one of my friends. He was a white guy, and he was expecting this young woman to, you know, one of our acquaintances to come along. And he says, 6 o'clock, she'll be here in time, let's pour out a drink for her. So we poured out a drink, and then she turned up a couple of minutes later, said, hey, you had a drink ready for me. How do you know I was here? And he said, oh, we knew you'd arrived. And she said, how? He said, well, I have an app on my iPhone. And she said, what app? Says the hairy bum detector. Well, she got it immediately and kind of exasperated. She sort of in a joking way made to hit him. So I remember that. You know, he says, I knew you were in the building because I have an app on my cell phone. What app? The hairy bum detector. I tried it out on various people. You know, I was a tutor and I deal with various people. I'm a consultant. I tried it out, and the ethnics just didn't get it.
Right.
You know, they're not getting it that I'm trying to say, you have a hairy bum.
Right, yeah.
They're not making the chain of connections. You see?
Yeah.
These are things that you're going to miss in your way of life.
And a whole lot more than that. But Frank, I want to, let's just talk about the book a little bit. I want to take a break here before we linger on too long. There's many more questions I have for you and things we need to discuss more in this second segment. But tell us a bit about, you know, what the plans are for the series. Obviously, the first one is out now. Tell us where people can get a copy. Do you have a website, etc., where people can read more?
Well, I don't have a website, but the book is out on Amazon.com. So anyone in the Western world can get the book off Amazon. And it's only about $9.99. So it's a cheap book considering that it's 700 pages. This book actually is written as a story. It's a fiction story. There are several families. And these people, slowly, as they see that the little things about their way of life are coming into are disappearing, that they're losing the very things that are precious to them, and they realize there's something very wrong, some of them get radicalized. Not that they want to, but it happens. Little by little, they get drawn into things. One man is actually in a cell. Shane Douglas, he's already in a cell that is working secretly, and they have a plan, and I'm not going to tell anyone the plan. It's not revealed in my book what it is they're going to do. All I'll say at this point is, he was coming from Seattle to Vancouver. And as he was coming to meet another cell, another sympathetic cell in Canada, he got intercepted and captured by the enemy, by an intelligence branch called the Scorpion of the enemy, the global enemy. And when they captured him, shortly afterwards they realized that they don't have his cell phone. Where's his cell phone? What happened to it? And they understand that there's something very critical on that cell phone. Well, there is. That whatever is on his cell phone is critical to this new kind of attack. I won't say it's a physical attack, but it's a new kind of operation that they have to try and disrupt the works of the enemy and wake up white people. That's all I'm going to say.
Hmm.
But that's coming in the second chapter more.
The second, there's more coming. Second part, yeah.
In the second volume, there's more.
Yeah.
But in the first volume, Sweet Dreams and Terror Cells, you certainly have a lot there. You have action. You have how the scorpion reacts, how the enemy gets the puppet government of Canada and of US to try and find these cells. You get an ideological battle because Shane Douglas has an ex-wife and a daughter, and his ex-wife is a very liberal person. And she has a titanic ideological discussion in chapter two with her siblings. And that discussion is important because it talks about the liberal mind and all the misconceptions. We present both sides of it. But it's important practically because when Shane Douglas needs the help of his ex-wife, whether she will help him or whether she'll turn him over to the authorities depends on how her worldview lies. If she still thinks that she's a strong liberal and Shane Douglas is just a hater, a white supremacist, an evil man, she will turn him over to the authorities. And if she has some serious doubts about that worldview and thinks maybe Shane Douglas, my ex-husband, has a good cause, maybe white people should not be genocided, maybe it is genocide, maybe it's not hatred, maybe it's not supremacism, she might help him. So we don't know which way she's going to jump yet. But the action is on the move. And I've revealed a fair amount, like, why do the sneak rulers want to genocide the white people?
Right.
What's in it for them? Yeah. I have a whole section on that, where one of the intellectual luminaries of the sneak rulers, of the New World Order, actually lays it out. This is why the whites are a problem for us. We have to blend them out, get rid of them. So there's a lot in that book that people would find interesting. There's a lot of specific mentions of how the brainwashing is done, how the movies do it. I think it would be a very pleasant read, all in all. There's a lot of humor, there's a lot of humor in it. But people in the book, there are people working for the government who begin to have doubts. Are we doing the right thing here, pursuing this cell? Who are we fighting for here? We have orders coming down right from the Prime Minister of Canada, but who are they serving? They begin to question their loyalty. So I think just as a work of fiction, it's a good read. Forget the ideological stuff. Forget the survival of the white race. Forget the unique qualities of it. It's just a good read as it is. And people would find a lot about the kind of mythic literature and stories that they don't much know about. Like I review The Wind and the Willows, a book called Watership Down about rabbits that had to make a terrible journey to find a new home. But things like Alice in Wonderland, why that appeals to the white heart so deeply.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many dimensions, so many different aspects. I think people would say, hey, that was quite a rewarding little read.
All right. Well, very good, Frank. Definitely looking forward to speaking more here in the second segment. We're going to take a break here shortly. But again, then, ladies and gentlemen, When Giants Break the Spell, that's the whole series title, if you will. And the first part here that we're talking about is Sweet Dreams and Terror Cells. And it's a Kindle version, but obviously you don't have to have a Kindle device to read it. You can get it on your computer. There's Kindle's app for your iPhone and iPad, and I think it's available for Android as well. So there's a number of ways you can get it, mobily or to your computer or whatnot. But yeah, as I said, Frank, a lot more questions for you. So stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back, and we'll continue with this in the second hour. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to continue with Frank Raymond in the second hour. RedIceMembers.com is the website where you can sign up and tune in. Stream or download, we have RSS feeds divided up by year, all the way back to our start in 2006. Our archives contain all previous radio programs, naturally. Also, all Radio 314 shows, videos, films, inside episodes, and more. Our upcoming guests include Kurt Doolittle, Matt Forney, Rob, Jan Ott, Matt Bracken, Stephen McNallan and other European AFA members, Blair Cottrell and Thomas Sewell, to name a few. As we proceed with Frank Raymond, we continue to talk about the white mind, traits, properties, and the things that we might not immediately think of when we discuss what is happening in the Caucasian world with migrant invasions, population replacement, economic immigration, and our obligation to carry the rest of the world on our shoulders, all fueled by guilt. So when you want to hear more, join us at redicemembers.com as we continue with Frank Raymond. Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with more.